session number 27083, reel 37.
So much happened during my two and a half years out in the Far East during this particular appointment that it's very difficult to know where to draw the line. I was taken or sent on visits to Borneo, of course, when the confrontation was on, to Manila to deal with things there, to Hong Kong routinely, and to Hawaii, to Honolulu, to talk to the Americans. These were quite long trips, and they were important, and heated discussions at the other end and so forth. Sometimes I was on my own, and sometimes the CNC went, sometimes the Chief of Staff went.
What were you trying to achieve when you went on these trips?
Especially, well, it varied with the trip. The trip to the Americans was an annual thing, and one year we went across to Hawaii, the next year they came across to Singapore. Hong Kong was really routine administrative stuff, and one went up from time to time, once a year, twice a year if necessary, and so on. Manila I was just asked to accompany Admiral Dreyer when he, with his wife on board alert, was really kindly giving me a break. And that wasn't it wasn't a business trip as such at all. It was very enjoyable. It confronted me with the embarrassing situation that the one night I had free there, and because of taking alert with Lady Dreyer as well, Mary went too, and we went to a particular restaurant that I'd been to before on some official due, and while there, I hadn't really paid too much attention to the bill and so forth, and I hadn't got enough money to pay the bill. And this was really very embarrassing indeed, in a foreign country. I mean, I had it on board, or had it accessible on board, at any rate. But they took me on trust, and I undertook to let them have it by midday next day. And that was decent of them, because it was some funny little things went on there. I mean, life didn't start until 9 or 10 o'clock. And then the nightclubs opened and the rest went on.
Yes, yes.
I didn't mention the Chief of Staff. In Admiral Lucy's time, the Chief of Staff was one Brian Durant, Rear Admiral, who I had never served with before, and who I found very difficult to get on with initially. It took me, I suppose if I'm honest, it took me the best part of my first year to come to terms with him. I did then. And thereafter, we were great friends and never looked back. He had a charming wife who sadly died of cancer, young, but he did not go on himself. And not long after Desmond Dreyer took over as CNC, the Chief of Staff was relieved by Brian Brain Nichols, who is an entirely different personality. Whereas Brian Durant had been domestically very well healed and tended to move in the top social circles and think the lesser of anybody who didn't, and that sort of thing. Brian Nichols, was just a very charming companionable and no fool human being, and it was as different as chalk from cheese. Brian Durant would tend to say, show that to my secretary, he knows how I like these things done. And his secretary was only a passer two and a half, and so forth. And this rankled, frankly. I didn't get on terribly well with the secretary either. But we came to terms, and that was fine. With Brian Ray Nichols, when I finally came to go, he came all the way to the airport to see me off. And that was unusual. And he later died of cancer in King Edward VII Hospital, where I was chairman at the time. And that was very sad. But I'm diverting rather. I had to go to Aden to liaise with the flag officer there, flag officer Middle East, because of the partly planning and partly the gleam in the eye of withdrawing from the Far East and the area in the Middle East. And I haven't much to say about that. Can we switch a minute? One of the things I had to do was to chair a CETO meeting, which was at captain's level. And this was an annual event, and it meant that I had to throw the odd lunch party and the odd dinner party and that sort of thing. And I thought I had arranged it, I had split the party because I couldn't seat them all in our little quarter there. I couldn't seat them all in one go. That I had half for dinner on Tuesday and the other half for lunch on Friday or whatever it was, sort of thing. And to my consternation, on the Tuesday night, there were two Americans present, and the American that I knew I had asked for lunch on Friday came for the dinner on Tuesday and arrived half an hour early, and there was I, stark naked, under a shower when the front doorbell rang. But thinking that perhaps he had done a swap with his chum and that all would be well, I let him in and just hoped and prayed that he had done a swap. Well, he hadn't. And in due course, the second American arrived. And we just didn't have enough chairs to set them all down on. There was one extra. And there were other chairs, of course, but they were sort of canteen, canvas affairs, and a bit in for dig, and the other chairs were quite nice. And we hastily reshuffled the seating plan, the dining room, and so forth. And my afternoon previously had been made hideous by the arrival of the Thai representative, who was a very senior captain, and a very pompous one at that. And rather a nasty little man, who I didn't take to at all, and he had a reputation. And I had deliberately put him next to me at one end of the table so that I could hopefully keep him in order. And because I feared that there might be trouble in that quarter, I put the Frenchman next to my wife at the other end of the table. And to leaven the load for both these parties, I had the wives, and hence their husbands, of one or two of our staff officers. And that was that. Well, we reshuffled the seating And we put this canvas chair, and it sort of fitted in best on the end, so it went next door to Mary. And the first thing that happened was that the Frenchman decided that it was unfit for him to sit in. But we got over that a bit, as I say. The Thai had arrived at Paya Lebar, the main airport, and no car had met him. There'd been a foul-up in the transport. Or so he said. In fact, he'd gone to the wrong gate at the airport, which is why there was no car for him. So he brought it on himself, and he eventually came in a taxi, and he was in a very bad temper, and so on. So we gave him a stiff glass of gin and tried to cheer him up, and so on. And sitting one away from me was the wife of my air engineer officer, a delightful girl, who was within a couple of months or so of having an infant. And when we eventually moved into dinner, to the dining room, it was all very open plan. We'd hardly sat down when I was aware that she gave a great heave. And I thought, oh my God, don't tell me that she's starting already. She'd never have come out if she'd felt like that. And these thoughts ran through my mind when she gave another great heave. And I didn't know what to do about this, so I pretended not to notice. And amongst those present also, but a very mixed party, was a senior Australian captain and a very, very brash officer. And there are a few more brash people than brash Australians. And he was both Australian and super brash. And he had already made his brash mark, as it were, by telling a joke almost as soon as we sat down, which was, without really much preamble, did you hear the one about, I spent last night between two thighs, I mean ties, I mean, and you could imagine what the Thai captain's reaction next to me was. And he was just about to explode when this girl started to heave. And then the Australian suddenly said, Eureka! And he held up one of these little chichas, these little lizard things that creep about the ceiling. And it had fallen onto the ground, onto the floor, and was being chased under the table by our Siamese cat. And you know how cats are? They detect at once if somebody is allergic to them. And this girl apparently was allergic to cats. And the cat went straight for her and did a bollard act against her ankles and so on. So she didn't have her infant at the dinner table. And then by arrangement, we all went off. But it was running a bit late by this time. And we'd booked the front row at the local barracks cinema. And we arrived about 5 minutes late, which held up the film, which is inexcusable, really, because it wasn't my film. And the film, as I well recall, was called Tea and Sympathy, which was about some young girl, or boy, I think it was, falling in love with his headmaster's wife. I think it was that way around. And anything less suitable for the occasion would have been hard to conceive. And I sat through this, absolutely grovelling. It was awful. And those were never just one incident of the sort of thing one went through. Another more interesting one was the second in command. Second in command was Jack Scatchard, now Vice Admiral, who had been the commandant at Latimer, where I had previously been. And he didn't really feature very much out there. I can't imagine why he was sent out as FO2, which was a plum job. But anyway, he was. And he, being now on duty free, I think I mentioned before he was slightly inclined to raise his elbow, and he did so rather more. And he fell foul of Desmond Dreyer, the CNC, who had been asked on board the flagship for dinner. And I don't know what had happened to Jack Scatchard, but he couldn't have forgotten this, and he was the host, and so forth. But he had too many drinks taken in the course of the evening, and he was still in tropical rig when the Admiral's car was approaching. They were alongside. And so he hurried away to put on mess undress and so on, and was not there to receive the Admiral, and everybody knew why, and so on. So that wasn't very good. And it was the custom for the Australians to send two destroyers or frigates, and New Zealand to send one frigate, because they had a much smaller navy, that did 6 months or so with our Far East fleet, and then rotated or returned with a bit of a gap, and so forth. And the time came for the two Australian destroyers, and they were good ships, the time came for them to go. And they threw a farewell lunch party for their immediate boss, who was FO2, Jack Scatchard. And I was included in the lunch party, and I was a bit anxious about this because I had to go to a JPC meeting in Singapore early on in the afternoon. So I felt my way with them, but they both said, "Oh no, it was going to be quite a short session. They weren't going to have a great session," and so on. Well, we had a glass of something beforehand, and eventually we sat down at table, and we had a good lunch. And immediately opposite Jack Scatchard, sitting on the right of the senior of the two captains, was a delightful little silver flagstaff on a little plaque, and hoisted to the truck of the flagstaff was a particular naval signalling flag, Flag Echo. And Flag Echo, as any professional knew, when hoisted singly at sea, at the yardarm, by the senior officer present, meant flag and commanding officers have time for the next meal. And that meant that flag and commanding officers could indeed go and rest or go and have a bite of food and that sort of thing. And it was a solemn tryst. And while that flag was flying, it was not open to the senior officer to play any funny buggers at all. Once it was hauled down, it was fair game for anything to happen. And just opposite Jack Scatchard was this little thing with Flag Echo at the masthead. Why? Because never in the whole of their 6 months had Flag Echo been hoisted at Jack Scatchard's yardarm. And of course, Jack Scatchard, not being frantically professional, didn't know what it was. He didn't know it was Flag Echo, and even if he had, he didn't know what Flag Echo meant. And he picked this up, and there on the plinth was presented to Vice Admiral J.P. Scatchard. I thought, God, and he put it down again. It was quite an interesting situation. He was relieved by a man called John Frone, who was a very different kettle of fish. A sharp cookie, very sharp, very dark complexioned, and known variously as Black Jack. And he sharpened things up. He was a highly professional man, and he did very well. He ended up as CNC Fleet, and I shall return to him later on when I did a particular job on his personal staff. And it became his practice he had his wife, who was a delightful person, but rather shy, and she came out for some period, about the middle of his time, when the flagship was in refit or something out there. And it became their habit to walk across a bit of open ground, which was just opposite our quarter, of an evening. And in due course I became aware of this. Half the time I wasn't back home then, but still. And I thought, and so remarked to Mary, that it'd be rather nice if I went down to the foot of our funny little garden one evening when I saw them walking past fairly close, and ask them in for a glass of grog. And I did this. And this was the first time I'd really properly come across him, certainly socially. He used to come into the ops room from time to time and discuss programs and so forth, but that was rather a different matter. And he came in and they each had a drink, and in due course they left. And as I saw him through the little gate in the fence, he said, "Do you know, I've been here 5 months now, and this is the first time. We've always gone for a walk in the evening when June's been here, and this is the first time anybody's ever seen fit to ask me in for a drink." And all the other houses were dockyard houses, which indicated something. Admiralty House was delightful. It was the right sort of size. It had a large swimming pool, a charming garden, and lovely rooms inside. And Lady Dreyer, Marjorie Dreyer, was a great character. It was Desmond Dreyer's second wife. First one had died. And I think I mentioned earlier that he said that he would come out to Malta and live in the flagship and so forth. And then he remarried at the last minute and so forth. It was a cracking success. They'd met fishing on the riverbank. And she was a huge character in her own right. She was a big woman, very intelligent, and she didn't give a fig for protocol and that sort of thing. And she decided that she ought to play her part in doing good works, etc. And she thought it would be a good idea if she invited the local Chinese community. The mums could come for coffee at 11 o'clock in the forenoon, and they could bring their little ones with them. And while the mums were having coffee, the little ones could strip off and dive into the pool and generally splash around. What she had not reckoned with was the fact that no way were the Chinese little ones going to strip off and expose their parts to the public. And this they made quite clear on arrival. Whereupon Marjorie Dreyer summoned the chief steward and said, "Go through my husband's chests of drawers and mine and all the other stewards and get every pair of bathing trunks and pants and jock straps and whatever and bring them here." And I'm told they mustered 52 and in they went. She was a great character. And there was another occasion when they had a barbecue in the evening. And this was wrapped around swimming before, and probably afterwards it was too late. And one of the, I think he was the Captain D out there, was a man called Godfrey Place, who was a VC from, I think it was the midget submarine attack on the Tirpitz. A nice chap. He's dead now, poor chap, I'm afraid. And at a certain stage in the evening, when we were all splashing around, and people were going down the chute at the end of the pool, and quite a lot of that was going on. And by this time, Godfrey Pace had put down a couple of G's and T's or whatever, and was feeling a bit more uplifted. And he made some rather unfortunate remark, like, oh, come on, this is all very tame. Why can't we do this chute properly? And he stood on the top of the chute, and he went down standing. He was quite athletic, and he went down standing up. And when the chute leveled off at the bottom, he missed his footing slightly, overbalanced somewhat, and as he went over the end of the chute and into the water, he caught the back of his head on the lip of the chute. And that was that. And one had seen him do this, but nobody really thought anything, and we'd all put down a couple or so by then. When the Commodore Superintendent of the dockyard suddenly turned round and said, where's Godfrey Place? And we looked around, and he wasn't. And he was on the bottom. And somebody went in, wasn't me, because I'm a very bad swimmer, but somebody went in and they pulled him out. And he was all right, but he'd swallowed quite a lot of water and he'd hurt his head. And of course, he was a bit concussed and he swore that he was perfectly all right.
Of course.
And so forth. There was another incident. I think I've very nearly covered it now. The time came for Mary to go home early, because she was approaching 2 months for having number two. And in those days, I think it's still the same, you're not supposed to fly within 2 months of, and so on. And that left me on my own for the last two and a half months. And it was a pretty lonely existence, but everybody was very kind to me. And that was that. And during our 2 years out there, we had decided that we really must pull our socks up and find a home, a house of our own. To which end, we had got ourselves onto the books of virtually every estate agent that were in the front or back pages of the glossies. And we were on the books of about 40 agents. And, of course, they sent us excruciating details of utterly unsuitable houses, not remotely lined up with the requirements that we'd stated, and so forth. And we'd been very restrained. We had sent, I suppose, three cables back to her father, inviting him to go and have a look at. And one had already been sold, and one wasn't what it said it was, and another, he reckoned, was quite unsuitable, and so on. And she only had now, as I say, a couple of months before she was going to have to stop getting about the country looking at possible houses and rest up and have number two. And I've been given a very generous Sunday curry lunch by the captain of the dockyard, who with his Egyptian wife had become great friends, and I reeled back to my cabin in the barracks and wrote a very carefully, rather long worded letter to my wife, exhorting her to get down to Dorset, where she'd seen a house, or somebody had. And it seemed really the only hope, to give it a quick once over and then make an offer, and anything to avoid it going to auction, which would up the ante. And this was on Sunday evening. First thing on Monday morning, I condensed this lot into a very brief cable and sent it off. And I suppose about Wednesday or so, I got a reply cable, which simply said, hold hard, offer for Wanston Lodge, which is the house next door, accepted. And I'd never heard of Wanston Lodge. Hadn't featured in any of the adverts, hadn't featured in her letters, and so on. And I didn't know what to do. But she'd obviously done a brave thing, and, you know, offer accepted meant that we were in business. And so I whipped off a further cable saying, well done, Wanston Lodge, fully supported, not having the remotest idea as to what I was doing. And off I went to Phoenix Park for the next meeting and so forth. And that was all I got. And so later that night I scribbled a letter. Didn't take long, it took about a week or so, I suppose. And I said things like, Wanston Lodge, super. By the way, which county is it in? Is it a nice house? Has it got a garden? Is there a railway station anywhere near? How much are they asking for it? And all the sort of utter basics that one needs in buying a house. And I went on, one way or another, for about 3 weekly letters. And in the replies that I got, rather cryptically from my wife,